that's drafted in America.
According to the experts, if a national treatment clause is included in the FDA's, it would mean similar treatment to foreign small companies. Given that foreign micro, small, and medium enterprises are very strong, it would create stiff competition for their domestic counterparts. The economists regard this as the real cause of concern, as providing a particular area means agreement to give access to other areas. Public procurement, being a huge market, is always preferred. In both scenarios, Indian businesses face danger of foreign entities entering the domestic market and increasing competition.
So we have discussed public procurement as part of free trade agreements of India with different countries. Now, let's switch to social media and see what people around the world have to say on this issue.
Let's now take a look at what the global media has to say about it. Mark Warner tweeted, "Public procurement of contracts worth over 200 crore rupees were opened up in the FTA signed with the UAE last year, and now every country India is negotiating with, including the EU, UK and Australia, is gunning for access to the public procurement market." John G. Murphy, an economic expert, wrote, "UK expects to strike FTA with India and accede to TPP in 2023, reports Bloomberg. The administration's view that FTAs are passé is a lonely one." Shantanu Singh, an economist, tweeted, "People aware of the development said that Indian companies, especially those in the IT sector, have also sought access to the public procurement market in the EU and the UK." Mint, a news portal, wrote, "The inclusion of public procurement in the UAE agreement marked a first for India, which has been notoriously shy of opening up this lucrative market to foreign companies."
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Contrary to the claims of the Modi-led BJP government, the intensity of attacks on the civilian population in Jammu and Kashmir has increased in recent years. These attacks have mainly been aimed on the minority Kashmiri Pandit community and the non-resident Hindus living in Kashmir. Experts say that the armed group strategy to attack the non-locals and minorities is a way to signal opposition to the means employed by the Bharatiya Janata Party to change the demography of the Muslim-majority region.
With the start of the new year, the state of Jammu and Kashmir witnessed the killing of four civilians in the Rajouri district by unidentified gunmen. Two more people, including a child, died the following day when a blast rocked the area. Conflicting with the return of normalcy as claimed by the BJP government, at least 18 non-local Hindus and Kashmiri Pandits have been killed since the abrogation of Article 370. According to the data provided by the government of India, the violence has seen no downward trend since the revocation of the statehood in the year 2019. The Modi-led BJP government had cited the special status of Jammu and Kashmir as the primary reason for violence. 229 armed attacks were recorded in the year 2021, leading to 40 civilian killings. The number went to 30 civilian killings in the year 2022. In the years 2017 and 2016, 279 and 322 attacks were reported, thus showing no significant improvement in the situation, as wrongly portrayed by New Delhi. The central BJP government has been asserting that the abrogation of Article 370 brought normalcy to the violence-ridden region. However, the opposite appears to be true. In the year 2013, prior to Modi's coming to power, only 170 cases of violence were reported from the Himalayan region.
Contrary to the popular belief that the COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc to the economy of Jammu and Kashmir, statistics show a different picture. After the abrogation of Article 370, the investments in the region dropped from $72.3 million in 2018-2019 to $36.3 million in the year 2019-2020. According to the government of India's recent figures, the investment has decreased by more than 50% since the revocation of the special status of the Himalayan region.
The claim that the abrogation of the semi-autonomous status of the state will lead to economic development in the region has failed on the ground. Last year in December, India's Minister of State for Home Affairs, Nityanand Rai, gave figures about the economic status of Jammu and Kashmir. According to the statistics, the investments in the region have fallen by 55% in the past 4 years. Previously blaming the local governments for the economic backwardness in the region, the BJP government in New Delhi has not been able to put the Union Territory directly ruled by the center on the road to economic development as had been promised earlier. According to the data published by the Indian Ministry of Home Affairs, the total investment in the year 2017 to 2018 was $102.8 million, considerably decreasing to $50.5 million in the year 2019 to 2022. And in 2021 to 2022, the investments were recorded to be $46 million, thus laying bare the false claims of economic growth in the region. Earlier, Modi-led BJP government would cite restrictions on the procurement of land as the main reason for economic backwardness of the Himalayan region. However, after the abrogation of Article 370, the government still has not been able to bring private sector investment to the state, thus ruining the economy further.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, contrary to the rosy picture painted by the BJP government, the civilian killings of the non-resident Hindus and Kashmir Pandits have increased. So the question is, do you think the armed groups have changed their tactics after the abrogation of Article 370?
First of all, we all should condemn the killing of civilian for whatever pretext somebody is doing this. Nobody can justify killings of civilians by any means, whether they are Pandits or non-Kashmiri residents or whoever. Having said this, that I think that the civilian Pandits, Kashmiri Pandits, or the non-resident Kashmiris are being made cannon fodder by the Indian government. Indian government has a plan to change the demography of occupied state of Jammu and Kashmir. For that, they are bringing in non-Kashmiris in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And they have changed not just the state of the disputed state, but also they have changed the laws about the domiciles and the residents. So that has enabled them to bring non-resident Kashmiris. And by doing this, actually the BJP government is fueling tension between different religions. So because the demographic changes being made in Kashmir are based on the religion, because predominantly Kashmir is a Muslim majority state, and which should have been something India could have taken pride in that, that it has a state which is majority Muslim state, and that suited Indian claim of secularism. But since the BJP is in power, which is a Hindu, fascist and nationalist government, they are trying to change the demography on the basis of Hindu Muslims. So they are bringing in more Hindus, and which are actually creating troubles for the Hindu Pandits, which are Kashmiris and very much state subject. They lived there for centuries, and they used to have very cordial relations with the Muslim majority of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. But now they are also in trouble because of these political policies of BJP, which I think which will not only backfire within Kashmir, but elsewhere in India as well.
Now, Mr. Khan, citing the special status as a roadblock to the economic development of the region, statistics show that investments in the region have fallen by 55%. Now, conflicting with the claims, has the withdrawal of the special status been responsible for the decrease in economic investments?
Hey, you know, this is very interesting that the BJP says that after abrogation of special status to Kashmir, they will bring in investment. While destroying the economy of Kashmiri traders and Kashmiri businessmen for almost now 10 years, consistently destroying the local economy, how can you actually improve the economic condition of the state, the people of the state? This is, I think, not understandable to common sense that local economy, you know, the blockade of the Kashmiri traders, it remained for months. And the Kashmir is practically in siege for almost 2 years now, and 2.5 years now. And you claim that you will bring investment, and that is not possible. And as you mentioned, the statistics have shown that it is not possible. Actually, it is hypocrisy at its best. Whatever the BJP government is trying to do in Kashmir is actually to strengthen its occupation. And for that, their sole objective is to weaken the will of the local people by whatever means. And they are trying to bring in, as I earlier mentioned, non-resident people. And now they are trying to bring in the business community of India into Kashmir while depriving the local businessmen of their own businesses. This is ridiculous. You cannot actually prosper as a state or a territory while the local people are deprived of their basic livelihoods and you are bringing in other investors. That's not possible. And this is the, this is the basic objective the Modi had presented Kashmir as a business hub for non-resident business community to come in and to benefit from the tourism and other businesses available in Kashmir. And the sole objective is actually to destroy the local businesses. Now, I think that will not work. Whatever India try, that will not work for India and not for the people of the Kashmir.
Mr. Khan, we've seen that violence in the region has not improved in the past few years as claimed by the BJP government. So has the centre's iron fist policy turned counterproductive in the Himalayan region?
History is a teacher, but we tend not to listen from it, not to learn from it. Everybody knows that you cannot crush the will of the people by iron fist or whatever strict policies you adopt. This is not for the first time India is adopting very strict policies. India killed more than 100,000 people in Kashmir, but the Kashmiri people never, ever, bore down in front of Indian pressure. They still demand their right of self-determination, and this is the will of the people. You know, whatever India uses sometimes stick, sometimes carrot, policy for the people of Kashmir. Sometimes they try to appease them, sometimes they try to coerce them. But both have failed in the past and both will fail in the past, in future as well, because the people of Jammu and Kashmir want to have their right of self-determination. And India should actually give them their the opportunity to exercise their right, which India itself had committed under the UN Security Council resolutions. And it was basically India which took Kashmir issue into United Nations, not Pakistan. India was losing the war at that time because the Kashmiri people had taken up arms, and this Azad Kashmir and Gilgit Baltistan, that was liberated by the people. And India was fearful that Srinagar was about to fall, and when India took that to UN Security Council, now India is obliged to fulfill its own commitments at international forums, which India is denying and which will cost India miserably in the future.
Now, Mr. Khan, last but not least, the incidence of violence in Kashmir has seen a downward trend before Modi's coming to power. So the question is, has the anti-Muslim policy of the BJP further alienated the people of the region and pushed them to the wall?
Actually, if we see the violence of the Kashmiri militant groups against the Indian state, that is irrespective of who is in power in the center, whether it is BJP, whether it is Congress, whether it is a united front of different political parties. The Kashmiri people are actually resistant against the occupation of India, and they want to exercise their right of self-determination, which was deprived by India. So the basic thing is that the militant groups, they will carry their work, whether it is BJP, whether it is some other government. But having said that, the strict policies which in BJP has applied on Kashmir, it actually help the militant groups to recruit more and more Kashmiri youth. There was a time that then there was a mix of non-Kashmiri and Kashmiri militants. Now we are seeing that majority of the militants operating in Kashmir are purely the Kashmiri youth. So that is a phenomena which changed during the BJP's government, that more youth is being radicalized in Kashmir and they are joining different militant groups. And this is for the first time in the history of Kashmir that during BJP's government, we have seen the presence of Daesh in Kashmir and we have seen presence of Al-Qaeda in Kashmir. It never happened. So that is the level of, suppression and depression among the Kashmiri youth, which can actually become catastrophic for India and for the region as well. So that is something which is new in Kashmir, and that is the result of the BJP's policies.
There you have it, Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the managing director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sharp Media Network tweeted, "No developments in Indian illegally occupied Jammu and Kashmir during last 4 years. The last 4 years have ruined the entire economy of Jammu and Kashmir, which has in reality collapsed. Unemployment is at its peak and youth is in utter frustration." Frontier Indica wrote, "It's no secret that under Modi, the security situation in Punjab has gotten much worse, and the benefits of revocation of Article 370 vis-a-vis the safety of common people in J&K, especially KPs, have also been short-lived." The Wire, a prominent news portal, tweeted, "The people of Kashmir say silence, fear, rising prices, and unemployment have taken over the region after August 5, 2019. Jammu-based reserve category employee working in Kashmir tweeted, "Situation in Kashmir is not yet conducive, but still being forced to resume duties. I don't know why. We are not with any Z security and weapon to defend ourselves, still forced by stopping salaries. Our life is also valuable to our old parents, if yours matters to your parents."
And that was our episode about the FTA's public procurement and the apprehensions of Indian business houses, and also the worrying economic and security situation in Jammu and Kashmir. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked an
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
در روایت داریم آخر از زمان مردم شباشون مثل سگا میشه تا پاسی از شب بیدارن سحر که باید بیدار باشن.
In a narration we read that people of the last days of the world live like a dog. They sleep during the day and are awake during the night. This means that most people will lose the precise timing for the salat of morning. If you sleep early at night, we'll be able to wake up early in the morning. Youth, especially boys and girls, should act based upon Allah's plans. Girls are born girls, and boys are born boys. Neither of them can be like each other. Unfortunately, in today's world, some girls behave as if they are boys. Even in a competitive race, some girls want to show that they are manlier than some boys. This is an absolute interference in Allah's plans of creation. Girls want to look like as boys, and boys want to resemble girls. This is in contrast with the past, that the young boys wanted to look as they are men. All in all, Allah has created all the people with a specific plan. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
القرآن يهدي للتي
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزای لازمی است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
ولا تتفرقوا فيه.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
كتاب
In the limelight.
Lake Powell, America's second largest reservoir and one that provides water and power to millions of people in Southern California, has reached its lowest level since its first filling in the 1960s. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. USA Today has covered this story and tells us more. Lake Powell, the nation's second largest reservoir and one that provides water and power to millions of people in Southern California, has reached its lowest level since its first filling in the 1960s. Its companion reservoir, Lake Mead, is at levels almost as low. Together, these reservoirs, fed by the mighty Colorado River, provide the water 40 million Americans depend on. Despite the storms that brought heavy rain and snow to California and other western states in January of this year, experts say it would take years of such weather to replenish western United States' water resources. In 2000, the two reservoirs, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, were 95% full. They're roughly 25% full now, said Brad Udall, a water and climate scientist at Colorado State University. It's hard to overstate how important the Colorado River is to the entire American Southwest. The water crisis in western United States is now very serious. Lake Powell is the nation's second largest reservoir. It was created by blocking the Colorado River at Glen Canyon in southern Utah and northern Arizona. It stores water as part of the Colorado River Compact and produces electricity through the hydroelectric turbines in Glen Canyon Dam. Work on the dam that created Lake Powell began in 1956 and was finished in 1966. It took 16 years for it to fill. At its highest level in 1983, the lake was 3,708 feet above sea level. Lake Powell hasn't been this low since June of 1965, just 2 years after it began to fill with water. The biggest worry is if the lake's level falls much lower, it won't be possible to get water out of it. But will the water stop flowing? That's a doomsday scenario, said Bill Hassenkamp, Colorado River Resources Manager for the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. Before things get to that point, the Department of the Interior will require reduction in water use. But how long until water stops flowing downstream? If the lake falls another 32 feet, about the amount it fell in the past year, power generation concerns become more urgent. Brad Udall said, snowmelt this spring is forecast to bring levels up somewhat. The water in Lake Powell is low because the amount of water in Colorado River has been falling for decades. At the same time, demand has risen due to increased population growth in western United States. Overall, the river's flow is down 20% in this century relative to the 20th century. More than four scientific studies have pinned a large part of the water crisis on human climate change. It's partly that there is less rain and snow, partly that as temperatures rise, plants use more water and more water evaporates out of the soil, which would otherwise have ended up in the river. In addition, the river itself experiences more evaporation. It's unfortunate that the largely natural occurrence of a drought has coincided with this increasing warming due to greenhouse gases, said Flavio Lerner, a professor of atmospheric sciences at Cornell University. That has brought everything to a head much earlier than people thought it would. Lake Mead is America's largest reservoir, a companion to Lake Powell. Lake Mead was created when the Hoover Dam was completed in 1935. It supplies water and power to Arizona, California, New Mexico, and Mexico. Lake Mead's level is 1,047 feet above sea level. You would have to go back all the way to April of 1937, almost 2 years into its initial filling, to find levels that low. It is forecast to have a new record low next summer, according to Hassenkamp. The lake isn't low enough yet to cause concerns about getting water out, but any hope of it refilling is years away, if ever, due to lowered rain and lowered snow and increasing evaporation. Some of America's largest cities depend on water from Lake Mead. It's 90% of water supply to Las Vegas, 50% to Phoenix, effectively 100% of the water supplied to Tucson, and 25% of water to Los Angeles, said Brad Udall. The Department of the Interior has asked the seven states of the Colorado River Compact to come up with a plan to cut between 2 and 4 million acre-feet of water by January of this year, but the seven states weren't able to come up with an agreement. The Los Angeles Times has also covered this story and tells us more. The desiccation of the Colorado River has left Lake Powell, the country's second largest reservoir, at just 23% of capacity, its lowest level since it was filled in the 1960s. With the reservoir now just 32 feet away from minimum power pool, the point at which Glen Canyon Dam would no longer generate power for six states, federal officials are studying the possibility of overhauling the dam so that it can continue to generate electricity and release water at critically low levels. A preliminary analysis of potential modifications to the dam emerged during a virtual meeting held by the Federal Bureau of Reclamation, which is also reviewing options for averting a collapse of the water supply along the Colorado River. These new discussions about retooling the dam reflect growing concerns among federal officials about how climate change is contributing to the Colorado River's reduced flows and how declining reservoirs could force major changes in dam management for years to come. Among the immediate concerns is that retreat of the reservoir dropping below the dam's power-generating threshold. If that were to occur, water would only flow through 4 8-foot-wide bypass tubes called the outlet works, which would create a choke point with reduced water-releasing capacity. There is now an acknowledgement, unlike any other time ever before, that the dam is now going to be suited to 21st century hydrology, said Kyle Roerink, executive director of the environmental group Great Basin Water Network, who listened to the meeting. They're not sugarcoating that things have to change there, and they have to change pretty quickly. Those who participated in the 7th of February meeting included dozens of water managers, representatives of electric utilities, state officials and others. They discussed proposals such as penetrating through the dam's concrete to make new lower-level intakes, installing a new or reconfigured power plant, and tunnelling a shaft around either side of the dam to a power plant, among other options. The Interior Department declined a request for an interview, but a spokesperson, Tyler Cherry, said in email that the briefing was part of broader conversations with state officials, tribal leaders, water managers and others to inform our work to improve and protect the short-term sustainability of the Colorado River system and the resilience of the American West to a changing climate. Kyle Roerink and two other people who listened to the webinar told the Los Angeles Times that cost estimates for several alternatives range from $500 million to $3 billion. The agency will need congressional approval and will have to conduct an environmental review to analyze options. The Bureau of Reclamation's presentation given by regional power manager Nick Williams included some additional alternatives that wouldn't require major structural modifications of the dam. Those options included adjusting operations to maximize power generation at lower reservoir levels, studying ways of using the existing intakes at lower water levels, and making up for the loss of hydroelectric power by investing in solar energy and wind energy. Glen Canyon Dam stands 710 feet tall, anchored to the canyon's reddish sandstone walls in northern Arizona, about 320 miles upstream from Lake Mead, America's largest reservoir. The dam has been controversial since its inception, with environmental activists and others arguing the reservoir was unnecessary and destroyed the canyon's pristine ecosystem.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is Zainab, and today we're going to discuss something very important with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi is a faculty member at Al Mustafa University. Dear listeners, in this program, we try to answer your questions and issues that you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Well, Professor Nakavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Well, Professor, we have a question here from Holland, and let's listen to this.
Assalamu alaikum. Hi, I'm Maryam, and I was wondering what Islam thinks of parents deciding their child's worth simply based off of their grades and how well they do in school.
So, Professor, there's a girl from Holland, and her name is Maryam. She's asking that parents usually judge their children on grades, and she wants to know the take of Islam on that.
When we're talking about school grades, normally it's the progress and the results of their studies and the subjects that they study. So certainly it is important that they have good results in what they're studying. But the question is what they're studying enough to develop a personality and a character which is necessary for a Muslim being, a Muslim person? He has to develop a character based on Islam, a personality which is based on Islamic teachings and Islamic principles. Are those studies going to create that personality? Of course, they will have an effect on that personality. They will the studies a person does, whether it's in the school or in the college or in the university, it will impact the personality of the person. But that is not the holistic thing that we're looking for. Yes, if we have a school or a teaching institution where all these aspects are taken into consideration.
All right.
All the aspects of human behavior are evaluated and assessed, and grades are given based on that, then of course such an institution's grades could qualify for being acceptable and for being enough. But normally that's not the situation. Normally whatever is taught at schools is just the books that are taught.
Mm-hmm.
Knowledge is given. Knowledge is one part of our personality, of our character. Much more than are the skills that we learn, or for example, the feelings, the attitude which has to be developed for life, for a pure life, for a living which is pure in Islam's view. So that requires much more. So just sufficing
on the grades.
On grades is certainly not what Islam would like.
Mm-hmm.
And parents should look beyond that also. And yes, professional development or formal education is required for at least making a living. And that is what it is for normally. Schooling is for schooling. We send people, our children, to schools, colleges, universities. So at the end of the day, they become good professionals and they can earn a living and become bread winners or bread earners. That's the whole purpose about that. So the major concern of the parents is that our child should make good grades, should have good grades, to become a good professional, to have a good occupation in the future, make money, have a good life and all that.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's based on the greed of the parents themselves. Look, if my child becomes a good professional, he will make a good living, he will earn, and he will also take care of us when we are old. So these are concerns which can be justified. They are acceptable. That is not bad, but that is not enough. So grades, yes, are important, but are not enough.
All right. Well, we'll discuss more on upbringing after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Professor Nagavi, and We just answered a question. There was a girl from Holland, Mariam, who says that when parents judge their children only on the basis of grades, what does Islam say about that? Professor, you said that grades are important, though, but only grades are not important. There are the factors that have to be taken care of. Well, there's one more question we have. Assalamu alaikum, my son is 3, and if he does something wrong, for example, if he throws water on the floor, etc., and when he is asked, why did you do this, he says, I did not do it, you did it. I was wondering, will he accept his mistakes as he grows up?
Yes, of course, if you're not going to scold him for that, and of course a 3-year-old child cannot be scolded for anything he does, even if it seems to be wrong to us.
Well, we can say that the mother has actually messaged at the very right time, because she wants to rectify this problem. She doesn't want her child to not to be accepting mistakes in future. So she's concerned as he's as young as 3.
So our major thrust upon this, that we should allow the children to make as many mistakes they can in this at this time of life, where there's no one, they're not responsible.
All right.
They should learn. They should learn not to make mistakes. But if they make a mistake and we start scolding them and questioning them about that, that should not be refrained from. We should try to deflect. We should try to intervene before they make that situation. They come to a situation, for example, why did he throw the water on the ground? Why the water was not kept away from him? Why wasn't it kept at a distance from him?
So you can actually yourself save him doing from any wrong things.
If there's something, which is really dangerous for him, or something which is bad, he starts throwing. Not only the water, he throws down the glass, and the glass breaks.
Now it's dangerous.
It becomes dangerous. So the mother should try to deflect that. It should be before that it should be, the precaution should be taken. The cure, it can't be cured. It should be a precaution taken in all situations which could lead to difficult results. Dangerous situations, they should be avoided. And then if the problem has come up and there has been a mistake committed by the child, of course, he is not to be scolded for that. He is not to be, even abused for that, even spanked for that. He's made the mistake. Just make him realize that it is a mistake by your expressions, by your facial expressions.
Show your kind of, if you're not happy with it, show that through your gestures, but not through scolding.
But well, not, and even not to make him, accept his mistake. Just say, that was not a good thing to do, was it? That's all. That's
ask
enough.
Ask him the question. Well, we'll discuss more after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Ya muqiy al khayrat, ya muqiy al khayrat, ya muqiy al.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Ya muqiy al khayrat, ya muqiy al khayrat.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqafi, and this is IRIB English Radio. Well, Professor, we're talking about a mother who was concerned. Her son was as young as 3 years old, and she was concerned if he accepts the mistakes when he grows up, because as of now, if he's doing something like throwing water on the floor, now he's saying, I did not do this. It's someone else, or you did it. So she was concerned. So you are actually trying to say that, first you said that the precaution should be taken care of. Second, you said that what I actually took out of your discussion was that maybe you have shown a behavior before wherein he thinks if he accepts his mistake and then his it's his time is like gone, he's gone now.
He feels that when we're scolding him, when we're telling him off, when we're trying to make him accept his mistake, or when we're scolding him for that, we're actually making him feel guilty about it. So he feels offended by that. So because even a small child has a certain sense of dignity, and he or she does not want to lose that sense of dignity. So if you start making him accept that mistake, he will, you know, start becoming defensive. So that would lead to a situation where he would then start to blame other people for that.
Yeah.
And he or she would try to deflect. The child will try to deflect the responsibility from himself or herself and blame it others to. So basically, we need to just make them realize that it wasn't a good thing to do. And you don't need to, you know, put them in the courtroom and say, why did you do it? Now you should be punished for it. No, that should not be the case, especially for children of a very tender age.
All right. So a child of a tender age, as per you, should be treated with utmost care, with utmost love, so that he does not actually go and pick up those things which are dangerous. Actually, the first thing that you said, that the dangerous things should not be kept around. Now, if throwing water on the floor actually annoys you, it could annoy you more that if the same water lets him slip on the ground and maybe he hurts his body or head or something like that. So the things that annoying you can yourself actually ignore them, keep them aside.
Exactly. And not throwing water or spilling water is not a big issue. Mostly mothers are very much put off by the fact that the child urinates on the carpet. And he needs to puts you off because it's become unclean. It's najis now. You have to wash it.
Yeah.
So, number one, nowadays we have these nappies to keep the child always covered, and he or she does not, you know, make the places where he or she sits doesn't make them najis and unclean. That is one way of taking care of it. But there should be a place, a room where your child is free.
And if you actually get annoyed with it, you can actually train the child yourself in different ways, because there are different ways on the internet. You can search out there. What are the different ways? It's actually a matter of a days or hours that you can teach. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us and sharing such beautiful thoughts. Thank you so much, dear listeners. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.